this going.
Very good. Thank you very much indeed. That's very good. Dieter, perhaps I could start with you, to, as we hope to have this discussion opening up to everyone. But Dieter, you're on my right. How difficult is it, in your experience, to establish strategic priorities in the context of city planning?
Yeah. Well, let me maybe start with Andy told the new confidence of planning. I think this new confidence of planning is strongly linked through the concept of planning by project, which is a very, very powerful instrument. It's also very powerful, for it integrates design. And it's not just to make a general theme, but it, you know, visualize a part of the city. But as I told yesterday, this approach, planning by project, has also a very strong weakness. So I would maybe reformulate our question. Has planning by project forgotten about city? How do we integrate the city in this planning by projects? For the strength of the planning by project is to take selective foci and mobilize partnerships. And this forms is always an exclusion, cutting up of the city, exclusion of actors. So this will be one of my main concerns. How can you, and I think what we also learned is that we can't overload the projects. So it would be ridiculous now to take the Olympic project to find a resolution of all the problems of London. But I think just this wonderful example of this design of this approach, we could see that we have, on one hand, we have this clear objective of the Olympic Games and the idea of urban Olympic Games. And then I think we should have another working level, maybe also another working team, which now already is starting the question of the post-Olympic impacts, the post-Olympic urban structures that is not overloaded for you. So there's a group of people working together with you, and there you have to have the vision. What are we going to do? And I think the problem of the most project is that you have very, very short-term questions, a leakage of office space. But that's not a vision for London. If you look the London, what is determining for London, Tony told us that 99% of the people coming in are coming from overseas. But these are the assets of the future. But they have to have a chance to get really the assets of the future. To how do they get integrated in this knowledge-based economy? And we have seen the dramatic divide in the employment development. The decline, the strong decline of the low qualified activities, and the enormous increase of the knowledge workers. But how do we, handle these problems? Yeah. And how do we handle this problem not only by education system, but by in the urban structure, in the urban fabric, integrated education system and perspective of careers, of possible careers? So this is, in my opinion, the key problem, that we have a second layer, a strategic layer, where we can integrate the different projects, and there we have to see what are the key problems of the future, and how can this be linked with these projects, which are mainly modernization projects, but which do not open really a sustainable perspective for the city. For we have a very strict, for all this, if taking up one of your notions, they mostly are efficiency-oriented. Mm. But efficiency is in contradiction to economic sustainability.
Yeah.
And this is a question how we can find a solution.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dieter. So there's a meta-project as well as individual projects, and the sum of individual projects don't necessarily make a city. Enrique, can I attract your attention? Do you see yourself as a mayor, as a designer?
Yes, clearly. clearly so, and I am also, as you, totally conscious of the enormous importance of design. And I would say that the purpose of urban design has to be to show that everything human is sacred, that in every detail the city must show that humans are sacred. And I do, at least I as a mayor, I had a lot of interrelationship with the architects and many projects even were proposed by me and then got an architect to, they were the contest and all this, but I am fully, I respect profoundly architecture because I, in Colombia, in Bogota for many years, many, even a public space was designed by engineers and it was a true failure, and architects can do wonders at the same cost, and they can have a very powerful influence in the way people behave.
Ricky, how would you find a way of articulating strategic objectives in relation to complex long-term projects, which are a way we know underneath that the strategy is going to change, it has to be developed as time goes on?
I mean, I don't know whether I can answer that question so directly, but I think just reflecting on what we've seen in these 4 days, the first thing that strikes me is that if you just took the words, the strategic objectives as articulated in the supposed briefs or the bullet points at the front, so to speak, they would all be exactly the same. I mean, if you saw Rem take out the text of the brief he got, yeah, it's exactly the same brief that I think Bob and Graham have for King's Cross. It's not the same brief for the Olympics, but it's certainly going to be roughly the same brief for Elephant and Castle, you know, maximizing quality, return, and all that. But of course, the architectures are very, very different. I want to come back to that in a moment, Frank. But I think that that sort of dissociation between brief, therefore, program and objective, and then it's the architecture that I think leads and is beginning in London to set that objective is the thing which I think is beginning to be quite interesting. Why is that? One of the two things we have to remember, which probably we haven't said, and being one of the organizers is my fault, we haven't said and we haven't discussed enough, 90% of London is private sector, 95% of London is built by private money. Very small amount is actually built with public funding, despite the sea change that's been in the last 10, 15 years. And the process through which that private funding is invested into the world out there, such as where we are at the moment, is through the planning system. And the great uniqueness, and it drives a lot of people crazy, and you heard Roger Madeline talking about managing anarchy. The great uniqueness of the system here is that it's negotiation-based. It's basically who knows who and who talks to whom, and the new sort of kid on the block here is the arrival of the GA with its London plan. I was fascinated that in these 2 days, I don't think we ever heard the word Unitary Development Plan, UDP. Do you know what it is? Probably not, many of you. But it is the one framework, the one planning framework, which actually articulates what should be happening in the boroughs we've looked at. There are two reasons why. I would say one is they're all out of date because it takes, what, between 5 and 10 years to get them approved. So by the time they're approved, they're totally out of sync with a city where the private market, and I return to that, actually is the one that makes the running. You know, this area here certainly has nothing to do with the UDP that was set in Southwark, and the new kid on the block going back is the London Plan. And it was interesting, again, that the only time the London Plan was mentioned really was when Tony says, you can't understand King's Cross unless you actually think that, I'm exaggerating now, Ken wants, Canary Wharf on steroids there, you know, or in White City. If it were not for the identification, which has happened sort of through the discussions on the London Plan, and I think with a great clarity about where these areas should be, these, so to speak, opportunity areas, I don't think many of these projects that we've seen in these last 2 days would happen. Now, back to, in a way, you're trying to answer your question, and I think the fundamental role of architecture. Because nearly all these projects, with the exception of the Olympics, are private sector-led in one way or the other, even Elephant and Castle will only happen if they're successful in getting in a major private bidder. There's very much a situation at the moment, all these balls being thrown up in the air, and let's see which falls first. That's exactly what's happened. When David Rundon was talking about we're on the verge of organic chaos, I think London has been like that for about 1,000 years, and it's fine. The question is to be very aware of what the disbalances and what the social and economic impact is going to be if one gets built before the other. And this is where I guess there's a warning of caution, a sort of word of caution, and but exactly goes to the heart of what this debate is about. That I think, while architects I think are having a great moment in London in many ways, they're playing with fire. They don't know you don't know what you're doing. I mean, I think there is a dimension of that which is actually extremely interesting. And not for a moment do I say that I do, but I think the level of discussion that we're having about the social impacts of design decisions is very important. We saw at least two zips being presented to solve the problems of White City, and we heard the words that a zip or a similar sort of architectural metaphor could solve the problems of East London. Surely that's not the case. And I worry about how the zip literally, those of you who didn't see Rem Koolhaas's presentation, showed that part of London like some jeans with a sort of zip opening, waiting to be closed to sort of reconnect the tissue of the city. And I think some of these ideas, which look good on a sketch, when sort of stretched out to the scale that we're talking about, have a danger of actually backfiring. And there I would say, Alejandro, can you take the image of the tissue of the body and explode it to a scale which is as big as from King's Cross to the river and actually make it really feel like that? And I think that's a very architectural problem which fits into the street, tries to answer the issues of what strategic objective you're trying to realize.
Richard McCormack, do you think architects are playing with fire? And anyway, and also secondly, what do you think about architectural metaphors on the whole?
Actually, a bit like Ricky, I didn't really want to answer that question. It just seems to me that something's come up here. Two things have come up which I would just like to address. The misuse of the word community, Frank, which you brought up, and this idea of the zip. This is a tricky metaphor, but I perhaps live on a zip, which is the interstitial condition between the City of London, which is the area where I live, the vertical, the north-south strip called Spitalfields, and the city's great sort of wealth machine, and then immediately within 100 meters or less to the east of where I live, 80,000 Bangladeshis who are not part of the knowledge community. And I think this is an issue which we're not going to address here, but it seems to me, as the experience in France has demonstrated in a horrific way, it's something we really have to address. And I don't know how you address it. I'm sort of almost embarrassed to raise it because I'm an architect and I feel a kind of ethical issue here, but I don't know what to do about it. It seems to me that the situation we're in is a situation which people like William Morris and Marx and great socialists of the 19th century saw in their societies. And it seems to me that the knowledge economy and knowledge is the equivalent of 19th century capital. And we've got to find a way of handling accommodating this disparateness between knowledge and lack of knowledge. So I leave a question which seemed to me to be an urgent question in the White City project, a big planning question for that borough, not just for the developers, for that borough, about the way in which sites like that site, which Rem Koolhaas described, are representing a knowledge economy, and on each side of it, on the other side of the kind of redundant motorway, and to a great extent on the other side of Wood Lane, though the BBC's there, to immediately to the west is a whole area which is outside the knowledge economy. Now, the other thing I just wanted to kind of respond to was Andy Altman's kind of bold announcement that bold visions are back again, and I suppose what I think it's one of the big difficulties we have as designers is ever quite understanding, perhaps we never can, the relationship which Frank talked of the physical and social, between the physical and social. I was reminded by the notion of bold visions of something that happened in the city of Lincoln in the late 19th century, which was at the spires of Lincoln Cathedral, arguably the greatest of the medieval cathedrals, became unstable. And the church decided they'd pull them down. And this created riots in the city. And I think that's really interesting. The people of that city recognized in themselves this huge importance of this iconic building. And so it seems to me that to be able to construct an environment of bold values, you have to actually somehow inspire in people some sense of what those bold values are. And let's be buy into what they are. Obviously, the Lincoln analogy is a sort of negative one, but it was true. And it's not about, you know, it's not about the things we architects, on the whole, are thinking about in the new urbanism, which I believe in to a great extent, the street system and what it does. It's about something else. It's about another level of consciousness. And finally, just picking up again on something Andy said about how ideas become dogma. I think that we forget the origination of values. An example, I suppose, would be that in the 19th century, the great Victorian parks, again, I'm thinking of the East End, Victoria Park, were created. They're wonderful places. It's a wonderful park. It really works. It's tremendously meaningful. I worked in local government, and such visions had turned into something called POS, Public Open Space. And this was the bureaucratic management of an ideal that had been reduced. And our management society cannot keep the vividness of these ideas. It always degrades them by turning them into something that can be managed. And that is a real problem.
Well, ideas become dogma, become box ticking, which is even worse than dogma. David, Adjie, do you, as an architect, find yourself capable of responding to complex differences in society and aspirations which are perhaps confused, hardly articulated?
That's another conference, isn't it? I mean, I think there's a kind of an anxiety that I guess the media is now sort of throwing up into the air that we're all sort of perplexed by, and this idea of the impact of global sort of migration and how that's, you know, and this idea of a kind of emergent second generation that's also kind of, you know, around in European northern and southern cities. And I think that architects, it's become incumbent that we address this issue of a kind of a non-singular sort of view of the city anymore. I mean, this might be kind of turning things a bit, but I think design, and I don't see this as a problem. I actually think this is a kind of an exciting addition to the repertoire that architects should deploy when they're looking at these issues. Because I think what is at stake here is that what is happening is that we have many stakeholders, and these stakeholders have to feel a sense of participation within this new idea of what the city is. And how do we do that? I think it means that we have to question those old models, and we have to look very carefully at what we're saying when we're building now. You know, what does that actually say to these constituencies that are emerging? And how are they going to kind of, you know, as it were, take on board these physical things that we're making, which, you know, have huge impact. So I think that there is a kind of a whole paradigm that's kind of developing, which is part of the 21st century, which, you know, is something that designers are going to have to take on board.
There is a question, a relative question, about how do you know whether you're right?
Maybe Richard, you should answer that. No, I mean, how do you know you're right, or how do you know you're wrong? I mean, it's the sort of, is that relevant?
Yes. I think it's relevant in the sense that, obviously, we're talking about very complex matters, and there's judgmental and there's subtle things there. But not to go back, not to investigate, to try to determine the degree of rightness that was achieved in that situation, to learn from that, is an ethical responsibility, it seems to me, of architects. That's my position. How does this conversation make any sense to you in your context?
This is really difficult now. Well, let me take this with transport context. Because as transport planners, we seem to have, we meaning the transport planners, my community, seem to have a lot of faith in planning and in planning scientific models. And, you know, having an impact and impact in the city based on those scientific models. But do they really work eventually? And if they don't work, what is it that we have forgotten? Is it the question of design that we have forgotten? Which eventually, to my mind, seems that, which has been raised earlier also, that really what we are talking about, whether it's planning or design, and especially in the context of transport, is the user. Some people have to go from point A to point B for various reasons. And if in our whole gamut of fancy models and scientific methods, we've forgotten the user and we have got involved with the planning for technology, we are planning for vehicles, we are planning for some monolith, you know, indicators like 20,000 passengers per hour or 30,000 passengers per hour. We have forgotten as a human being when I step out of my house and I need to reach my place of work, what are my compulsions? How am I going to use the system? And I think that is what the failure, if I have to say, is of planning and design for that matter. Because eventually it is the connectivity that has to matter as a user to me. Whether I talk about, you know, this fancy mega project like King Cross, where you are going to have an international terminal where people are going to come and there are a huge number of people in transient, versus local people who are just doing their daily activities. But eventually, what are they experiencing? As a person, as a user, when I come out of this rail system, how am I going to react to this environment? Is it physically and it is socially secure for me? Can I respond to that? Do I feel secure in using that system or not? I think it is this gist that as a planner we really have to internalize in our models and designs. And today I don't see that happening in a lot of transport projects. So I think it's this articulation of, so in some senses it is not planning versus design. It is, I think, in both cases the internalization of the user's perspective. Eventually, cities are also meant for people. Cities are not for vehicles. Cities are not for some technology. And cities are not for some business developments. After all, who are the cities for? I think this one very basic question we have to ask as technocrats, as planners, and that is what we seem to have forgotten in this last few years of scientific methods.
Yes, so scientific method against human imagination. And Ed Sohar, from an urban, very big scale level, how would you respond to these questions of imagination?
I think it's an extension of the previous section. Rather than looking at what's been forgotten, whether planning has forgotten about design or design forgotten about planning, I guess what I'm talking about is what both have forgotten to talk about in the sessions for the past 2 days, and particularly in the mega projects. This is sort of like a thousand interventions that I've saved up, so I'll try to be as quick as possible in responding. And it has to do with the first issue has to do with an understanding, indeed, of scale. You mentioned larger scale. The fact that much more so than 20 or 30 years ago, we're engaging in urban design projects that are being affected by a multiplicity of scales that have not really been recognized in most of the discussions. They've been simplified, for example, by the mayors, by the very definition of their territory and their turf, into just two scales, the municipal scale and the central government scale, the struggle for power between the two. This forgets about the scales in between the city and the state and the scales above. For example, every one of these projects is being shaped more than ever before by the global scale. We all sort of recognize that, but never really investigated explicitly. And the supranational scale, the EU is shaping so much of what's happening in ways that didn't exist for similar projects 30 years ago, and as I will come back to in a moment, the kind of regional scale. The problem of scale can be also discussed with regard to both designers and planners, that there's a kind of project fixation, a site fixation, which sometimes has continued into the discussions here. Maybe you do a few adjacent impact areas, but one must have a greater understanding of these multiple scales shaping things. For example, I don't think there's anything in the Olympic project in the Lee Valley that is going to have any significant effect on the real problems of East London. That I think East London has been metaphorically almost orientalized in a Said sense as something constructed as a kind of symbolic image of what's going to happen. I think it's going to heal a scar in the urban tissue, but it's not going to do anything for East London. That it fails to recognize that there's a degree to which whatever is being planned in the Lee Valley is going to be shaped very powerfully by two great forces whose waves are shaping everything in London, and they have to be included in every discussion of a mega project, and that's the City of London and its extraordinary shaping power for every corner of the London region, and of course now also Canary Wharf, which dots the eye of the exclamation point of the Lee Valley project. So this is one. Two, there have been major transformations in cities over the last 30 years. And in many ways, we're still talking about cities in this new urban age as if it's the old urban age. We're still talking about cities 30 years ago, not recognizing enough of the extraordinary transformations that have been taking place, more than perhaps any other period in the last 30 years. For example, we mentioned knowledge industries, but we continue to use this really misguided concept of post-industrial to apply to New York or to London. London is not post-industrial, nor is New York post-industrial. What has happened is that people who looked at what was happening the beginning 30 years ago when deindustrialization started began to say, oh my God, industry is going to disappear. And this early thesis of post-industrialism rose. It's not. There's been a reindustrialization process. I was really happy to hear the Lee Valley planners talking about reestablishing industrial clusters in the Lee Valley. Industrialization is still with us, and we're missing that. Another transformation has been we still think of a simple dual model of city and suburb. That model has been mushed, blurred in ways that we still haven't recognized. We're seeing this paradoxical notion of the beginnings of the urbanization of suburbia, and indeed a kind of, if you want, suburbanization of many inner cities in terms of de-densification, re-densification, a much more complicated process. And what's being produced is not a city and suburb anymore defining a metropolitan area, but a kind of complex, polycentric, networked city region, right? And hence this vital importance of my third point, of the regional scale. A very uncomfortable one for urban planners and urban designers and architects, that we need much more of a regional vision. And by the way, this doesn't equate to the GLA. The GLA is based upon an extension, a little bit, of the GLC, which was the London region 30 years ago. You all have in your book a map of the commuting zone of London. That's the London region. That's the greater London region. It includes Cambridge. It includes Oxford. It includes Brighton. And in that region, you're still seeing massive reindustrialization taking place. For that region, you're still seeing population growth. I heard the mayor of Budapest said Budapest is declining. And it's not declining. It's one of the most expansive, it is the most expansive region in Turkey. Then I heard something which is, of course, accurate, but maybe exaggerated, that people are leaving London and going out of the country. They are not going out of the country entirely. Many people are leaving London and going to Cambridge. They're going to other parts of Greater London. But we still become fixated on the territory. Okay, I guess basically this need to start defining a regional vision and indeed addressing issues such as regional governance that has been, I think, neglected and forgotten by most of the discussions here.
I think that's, thank you very much indeed. I think there is scale is enormous important, but there's also related to that the political geography seems to be increasingly out of step with the economic and social geography.
Absolutely, yes.
Dan, you're the author of 50 Mile City, so perhaps, and an architect, so you really ought to say something at this step.
100 Mile City, actually, yes. I actually found myself thinking about yesterday and the moment I found personally the most uncomfortable, which was when we were shown the film which won it for London, the Olympic film. And I found myself thinking about Lili Riefenstahl, and I found myself thinking about how there is a dichotomy, I suppose, between what we're doing. Andy talks about the return of the big idea in planning, and I suppose there's always a sort of dialectic between the idea of trying to avoid the sense of we're actually doing anything difficult or uncomfortable with planning, that we're actually reducing big ideas to numbers and to anemic formulae and, I suppose, banality, as opposed to the idea that planning is about big ideas and visions and stories and narratives. And that film, I suppose, was the kind of sense, this is a big vision and a big narrative, and it's why we feel slightly uncomfortable about it. I'm sure I'm not alone in that. And I suppose that made me go on to think about The Fountainhead, which is a film and a book which I always find illuminating. And I suppose it's usually kind of a story which is cited to show how naive architects are about what they're doing, that they should be allowed to follow the dictates of their own genius and left to get on with things. But maybe it should tell us something about how most of us see developers, that we actually believe that developers should be in the situation of a fountainhead, that we should actually understand this complex process as a strong individual, a leader, a man with kind of a line of credit to a Swiss bank, comes with a formula to say, design this problem, solve it for us. And of course, it's not like that. Maybe the model for development and the process of city making should be something a bit like filmmaking. And filmmaking depends on agents and stars and script writers and, again, some money and location finders. And in this kind of complex, maybe the architects are sometimes the stars. We need to sign up, you know, Angelina Jolie or Matt Dillon to actually make a movie, and we need to actually kind of get some cash and, you know, do we shoot it in Budapest or Washington or London, or do we actually make one stand for the other? And I guess in that sense, the script writers are the planners. And as we know, script writers keep being written and rewritten and rewritten, and we hope they get happy endings or not sometimes. And finally, I suppose, London has now created in its mayor a fountainhead for development.
At least in the movies, everyone gets the credit at the end, don't they? Which is not what happens in our field. Alejandro.
Yes, I would like to reply to this statement that the Olympics are not going to do anything for the East of London. I would bet a substantial amount of cash with you that if you come back to London in 7 years and go to the Lee Valley, it will look nothing like what it is now. Probably also. They will have a kind of effect that far into the urban economy. So, and in that sense, I think that despite the fact that obviously in being involved and doing all these projects, there is an enormous amount of anxiety and uncertainty. I think that we more or less know what we are doing. In that, I wanted to answer to Ricky. I think that we can say quite confidently that we know better than, let's say, 99% of 0.9 of the population how this process should be conducted. We don't have absolute certainty, but we have the teams and the knowledge, probably better knowledge than ever before in the history of urban planning, to get it right. And I think that we should claim that. And that also has something to do with what you said, what was mentioned about has these projects forgotten about planning? No. In fact, I think when those projects are interesting is when they are able to incorporate planning as a systemic question. When design is able to incorporate planning as a systemic question, and that's when also we are more likely to be able to assess and to verify and to test and to come back to what we are doing try to make sure that we get it right. That's also why I get a little bit nervous when fragments are put forward as the way forward, because fragments are precisely not about systems. Yeah. And that's when any possibility of verification disappears.
Well, thanks very much for saying that, Alejandro. It's absolutely important that what is really, really useful in this discussion is to remind ourselves that the criteria will change, the caravan will move on, things will develop. So the testing process has got to be intelligent. Joanna.
I wanted to sort of just add a few observations. I mean, given this is a very international gathering, I've done a sort of had a few visits where I've sort of been lucky enough to talk about planning and how people integrate design with planning in different cities. And I'm always really astonished and struck about some of the differences. And I just thought you might want to hear about some of them. So we all know much of this, but I think it might contribute to the discussion. The key question is to who's actually in charge of planning. And I want to give you the example of Vancouver, where Larry Beasley, who's the head planner, the chief planning officer, and a fairly astonishing character within the Canadian industry, makes all the planning decisions without reference to politically and democratically elected councillors or anything like that. And that's how that city has decided to run the planning process. And it's decided that planning is something that is... and design is something that you analyse technically. And actually, the politicians are very happy to not be part of that process because they think it sort of, in some senses, compromises them. It's quite a challenging approach compared to what the approach that we all sort of operate under, or most of us probably in this room. Go across to the other side of Canada and go to Toronto, and the astonishing thing is to realise that Toronto actually acts under a different planning process to Ottawa, to Vancouver and other places. And there, matters of design and particularly colour and use of materials are not allowed to be discussed in planning. So planning and design are completely split, or rather planning is rather disenfranchised in terms of design. And just the context in the UK, I think, is also important to really just reiterate some of the points that were made. We are at the point where, in terms of central government, planning has been and design have been absolutely inherently linked in a statutory way. And I think what we're seeing are more and more people within local government making that connection. I think the challenge is about at what scale we should plan, and then therefore at what scale we should design, and at what scale we should govern or have government or governance or whatever, is probably one of the biggest issues we're dealing with in the UK at the moment. We would all dream for local government reorganisation, but in fact what we've got is planning reorganisation, and I think planning reorganisation is not actually going to give us what we need, because we're dealing with sub-regions that do and don't work at various levels, cities that and their suburbs and inner city areas that don't work at certain levels, and we need to be able to think across all those scales. So a couple of things. Who's in charge? It varies. It's astonishingly varies. How we actually connect planning to design in a sort of formula in a statutory sense, and also very importantly, who and how we critique the design that's being offered, and the role that planning plays in that.
Thank you, Joanna. Young Ho Chan,
You have a way of looking at this local situation. What is your comment on it from your perspective?
If I can actually talk a bit about planning in general, I actually rather stunned if we say planning came back. I didn't know it was gone for a while. But if it did come back, it really came back in its original kind of rather static way, I have to say, because it really didn't address the issue of time much, it seems. So that it's offering a fixed, final, if not actually frozen image, which I really don't think it really helps for a city or a region to really to map out the development. So somehow, of course, I understand that sometimes, especially design, not much as probably planning, and it is used really is for marketing, is for promotion, so that this fixed image becomes rather important. But in the end, I really think planning can only be a process. If it's about a 20-year period, we should have 20 master plans and then make sure, ask for 20 design fees. Probably we won't get it, but because of that, you know, I was very frustrated by the actually King's Cross project because it was very clear. You know, I'm sure it would work, but the complexity was reduced of the site to such an extent, becomes purely technical. And then the only way to deal with it was to remove it because of that. Because who knows what's going to be in that place? I have very little knowledge of the city of London. But I would imagine 20 years later, London will be quite different. But the planner and architect were us, and they were able to deliver you a very, again, fixed image. So I thought the authors, probably they were just as frustrated as I am. So, and then of course, you know, for the Olympic project, although it's not much we have seen, but at least there are two periods. So I wonder actually those two periods, the 2 weeks for the Olympic Games and whatever the lens afterwards, could be actually rather drastically different. So my concern is the issue of time.
Thank you very much. Deborah, you wanted to say something. Yeah.
I was trying to think about the issues about being a designer in London and how this situation of partnership that Gerald talked about yesterday really affects the relationship between planning and design. And I think it's been particularly illuminating just to think about what we actually do here, people like David and myself making public buildings in London, and how we are just immersed in this culture of partnership. And I found that very, very helpful to sort of stand back from it. And it's really sort of made me question whether the work we produce is better or worse as a result of that context of partnership. And I think coming down to the question that David was posed about, is it right or isn't it right? I think it's the sort of rise of judgment has come back, of architects having to exercise judgment. I think for a long time, designers were just expected to do what they were told and not really exercise that judgment. And I find myself personally in the situation of a negotiator, as a mediator, where I'm having to exercise huge, huge spans of imagination to bring about fantastic, innovative design whilst talking about transport. You know, we're working on Parliament Square, for example. We're talking about transport, we're talking about security, we're talking about history, heritage, we're talking about public space policy, and we're talking about fundamentally about democracy. And somehow, within this kind of partnership culture, we have to exercise this judgment. And I think it's a very fortuitous moment that there is a lot of opportunity at the moment to make architecture and to be involved in partnership in a way that when I think David and I or Alejandro were students, the idea that we'd be involved in this scale of project was unimaginable, that we would, you know, have these opportunities. So.
I want to go to Jerry in a moment, but Enrique, you have a comment.
Thank you. Well, I'd just like to emphasize that I enjoyed very much, I appreciated very much your presentation at first, Frank Dufy. When you said some very powerful things, then my opinion, you say express, I took them down because I hope to cite them later. the expressive capacity of design is to reinforce values. And design potential can be unleashed when it is related to purpose. And design is at its best when it can be catalytic. I mean, I do believe like that design is very, very powerful. But I think we have had a confusion because we all have a sort of construct inclusion. It cannot create equality of income, but it can create equality of quality of life and these sorts of things. So I think it can be very powerful in these senses, but we must be aware of its limitations.
Well, thank you for that reminder. Jerry, we're coming to the end now, but I particularly would like your thoughts on how do you deal politically with these loose constituents of interest that have no formal structure, but are nevertheless incredibly important to an economy like ours?
I'd like to address that slightly indirectly I'm not an architect and I'm not a planner. So I want to ask the question, do architects want planners to get involved in design? And I think they're ambivalent about it. I think when they're working in their office, the last thing that architects want is planners to get involved in their designs. Planners are already involved in many details of their work, zoning codes and building codes and setback requirements and light, all the envision to St. Paul's and all the rest of it. So their ability to actually design something is constrained. Keep in mind, planners work for the government. And so if the planners understand, this is the fixed vision that Young was saying. So to the extent that architects are working in their office, the idea that planners are going to get involved even more in the details of their project is something that they would object to. And then they go home and they walk outside their office and they look at the city and they say, you can't allow this to happen. Look at all this junk that's being built. Look at them tearing down a building that should be saved. We should actually organize our society in order to take design seriously. No one is seriously considering architectural values when they're engaged in planners. And at that moment, they just flip over. And then they want actually planners to get involved in design. Now, I think we should recognize the ambivalence. On one side, the architects can move back and forth. They're sometimes in the society, in the market society, doing their own work, don't want government to regulate them. But sometimes they're members of the public and want design to be taken seriously. We shouldn't romanticize either side of it. We shouldn't romanticize the heroic architect doing it all by himself. And we shouldn't come off with various ways in which we can pretend that government involvement planning is benign. There's nothing benign about it. So there's many ways we can make it be benign. We can make a board of experts in which we think everyone's going to be reliable, or we can appoint Ricky, better still, to be an advisor because he'll decide the right thing. Or we come up with one of my favorite phrases so far used today is managed anarchy. Manage anarchy. The good thing about it, if you keep repeating yourself, is it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. It's a combining of the opposites of management and anarchy. We celebrate anarchy. The other thing that people worry about in terms of planners is it's rid of edginess. What really it sanitizes instead of edginess. So I call for sanitized edginess or edgy sanitation. So what we're involved, but I'm calling for design to be part of planning. That's what I'm for. I'm for design to be part of planning. We should recognize it as controversial. We should recognize it as political. We should recognize that architects need to get involved in politics. And indeed, with respect, politicians need to get involved in architecture. So we should all be asking questions like this. Is there a way to design these four projects so that we will attract immigrants from South Asia and Africa into mixed-income housing? Not just housing for immigrants from South Asia and Africa, but mixed-income housing, and mixed-income people from South Asia and Africa as well. Is there a way to combine poor housing and housing for middle income? And here's what I want. Architecture is not an answer to this, but it has a role to play. I want us to think about how to design housing that will attract both immigrants and others. And then I want the politicians to think about it too, all at the same time. And the answer will be controversial.
Very good. Actually, yes. Nikki, please help us to finish.
I came back for this session because it's so at the nub of what we have to grapple with at the GLA, and I was I'm very interested now, having listened, as to this idea that design should be part of planning. And I think to a certain extent we're trying very hard at the GLA to make that the case. We first of all, you know, Andy was very interesting in terms of the re-emergence of planning. We had no planning. We had no plan for London for 30 years. We had, after Mrs. Thatcher abolished the GLC, we had a very fecund 14 years of no government in which actually, although, you know, investment declined, et cetera, we actually had a lot of time to reflect for London. And that's why we've been able to get going so quickly, because in fact there was all sorts of advice being given to government and not taken, and we had it all there in a way to build on immediately and get a London plan out and quickly. And the main aim of the London plan is the sort of the big overarching stuff, which is, I haven't heard talked about here today much, which is, or yesterday, is the east-west imbalance. You know, how are we going to redress the big east-west imbalance in London? And that's, the Olympics has rebranded the East. The bid alone rebranded the East in a way the plan could never have done. But it's there anyway. I can't go into detail. But we also wanted to put in the big wedges. Somebody talked about Cambridge and the relationship with the region. Of course, that's in the plan too. You know, the corridor that goes from Stratford all the way to Cambridge via Stansted, the corridor that goes all the way to Europe, the corridor that goes out in the West and so on. That's there, this big strategic thinking. And then the areas of opportunity, the areas of intensification. And then there are lots of other things that are not in the plan. All the stitching in of the social and so on. Endless bits of other work, supplementary planning guidance and so on disability access, on housing allocation, on all this. It's there. It's stitching in all those strategies. It's not all in the plan. It's connected to it. But what is interesting, I think, is this idea of the master planning. The master planning for these areas, these set pieces that you've been talking about. And I don't know whether you're talking about strategic planning or the master planning of those areas and then how that interrelates with the designers. I'm not being clear from this. I've also not been clear about what you mean by design. Because I don't think architecture is design. I think it's part of design. And I look to architects to be the animateurs of much of this and to be problem solvers in a very holistic way. And I don't know whether all of them are capable of being that, but I'm just saying if they're not, we do need, I mean, I see design, urban design, is about interdisciplinary teams of people working together. You're never going to get it all out of, you know, it's those teams. And I think that comes together in the master planning process. And I'm actually looking to you to help me. But all I can say at the GLA is, Elephant and Castle has been before Ken and I three times. It's now much better than it was. White City came up before the GLC, and I was chair of LPAC, and we said, we can't have this amount of retail on the edge of the West End. It'll kill the West End. It's bigger than Brent Cross. What will it do? And we've done lots of thinking about that. King's Cross, I mean, I was in a UDAT in 96. You know, we've been thinking about King's Cross. We've been, you know, there have been three different schemes for King's Cross. I'm just trying to say, all this is evolving. And, I mean, I'm looking to you to help with some of these questions, because I think the GLA needs to be even more involved in the design side. And I'm not saying we are going to do it, but we need to be more involved in it.
I think what you're saying, Nick, is that planning and architecture, urban design, are subsets of design, and design is a subset of politics. And thank you all very much indeed.
Mention one thing. We've actually been allowed access to go up the ramp, for those of you who have never visited this building, and actually stand outside the main council chamber and see the part of the building which is not normally accessible. So if you just make your way up the ramp and never stop, but come back in half an hour. Bye.